The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity. Dijang planting the fields. The pointer. Scholars plow with the pen, orators plow with the tongue. We patch-robed mendicants lazily watch a white ox on open ground, not paying attention to the rootless, auspicious grass. How to pass the days. The main case. Dijang asked Zhushan, "Where do you come from?" Zhushan said, "From the south." Dijang said, "How is Buddhism in the south these days?" Zhushan said, "There's extensive discussion." Dijang said, "How can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat?" Zhushan said, "Well, what can you do about the world?" Dijang said, "What do you call the world?" Hong Zheng's poem. Source and explanation variously are all made up. Passing to ear from mouth, it comes apart. Planting fields, making rice, ordinary household matters. Only those who have investigated to the full would know. Having investigated to the full, you clearly know there's nothing to seek. Zhifang, after all, didn't care to be enfeoffed as a marquis. Forgetting his state, he returned, same as fish and birds, washing his feet in the Kanglong, the hazy waters of autumn. So, for those of you who have been here for the weekend, this is an example of the koan that is important, kind of, I would say, come perhaps extraordinary aspect of Zen practice and a body of literature, of religious, spiritual literature that has the express purpose of being practiced, of being an aspect of meditation, which is really true of virtually everything in Buddhism. When you think of Buddhist artwork, for the most part, those pieces of art are intended to be used in meditation. And so the koan, they have these classical sort of formats. There's a pointer. There's a main case, which is the koan itself, what the student sits with as a meditation, and there's the verse. And the koans each are pointing to some fundamental aspect of the student. And so it's a way to very directly and ultimately non-conceptually, free of the intellect, free of ideas, to have a direct encounter with one's self-nature, the nature of things, the nature of the world. Buddhism traces its history to Bodhidharma, Indian monk who came to China and who is said to have presented Zen as a special transmission outside scriptures that doesn't rely on words and letters. It's a direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of Buddhahood or enlightenment. And so what about all these words and letters? What about these sutras that are so abundant within Buddhism and certainly in the Zen tradition? I mean, here's a bunch right here, and I'm adding to it. So what about all of this? How is Buddhism in the South? Dijang asks his student, Zhushan, who Zhushan came to be a student. There's extensive discussion. And extensive discussion tends to lead to more discussion. Meanwhile, time is swiftly passing by. When there's no real affinity with those teachings, they're just words. They might be intriguing, they might be interesting, they might provide interesting conversation, but that might be it. But for somebody who's within whom something is stirring, those words, the teachings that a person encounters, can ignite a fire. or fan the flames of a fire that's begun to burn. They're not just words. Hopefully, ultimately, and maybe even in the immediate, the student is not primarily interested in a discussion. Dijan lived in the 9th, early 10th century China, was a student of Zhuangzi, and Zhurshan was one of his students. The pointer says, scholars plow with the pen, orators with the tongue. People use different things to do different things. Patra of mendicants just lazily watch a white ox on open ground. The white ox is the self. So the monastics study the self lazily in a relaxed way, are watching this self, studying this self on open ground. Let it be open, not constricted. There's no need to confine this ox. It comes in to practice confined, right? We don't want to confine it further. But we do need to pay attention, or it's going to wander off into the woods, into the weeds. It'll get lost. So when Zhurshan came to Dijang, Dijang asked him, where do you come from? And the footnote to that says, can you say he doesn't already know where he comes from? That is Dijang. He's not really asking him, where did he sleep last night? Or from where did he travel? Where are you coming from right now? Are you coming from yesterday? Are you coming from tomorrow? Are you coming from confusion? Do you remember the question I just asked you? Where is the you that seems to come and go right now? Dijang said, from the south. He's a monastic. He's been in monasteries training in the south of China. And Zhurshan said, or Dijang said, how is it going down there? How is Buddhism these days in the south? And Zhurshan said, there's extensive discussion. We could talk about Buddha Dharma all day and night, and nothing would change. We all enter practice with our thinking minds, right? Having spent so much of our life with that thinking mind and our thoughts, we trust them. We might love them. We will find them hard to let go of. But if the person is ready, then something is stirring. There's already some understanding about those thoughts, this mind, about how far it can take you, where it can take you, where is it that you want to go. And that's where, when we encounter the teachings for the first time, you know, it's said that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. In a certain sense, the teacher's always there. The teacher's always ready, just waiting for the student to appear. And sometimes that begins with encountering a teaching, some words, and feeling something stir. It's like meeting some ancient part of yourself. And then in that moment, it's like an awareness, like there's already something that you know, something that's being like a string on an instrument that's being plucked. And the string next to it resonates, vibrates in tune. Sometimes it's as though a person hears those words for the first time, and it's like you've been waiting your whole life to hear those words. Somebody understands. When I was young, my girlfriend was a little older than me, and she had a car. I don't know how I got her to do this, but I talked her into going to different churches on Sunday. And because I was not a church-going lad. And I, after a while, for a long while, you know, I was a teenager, so I knew pretty much everything. So I thought, religion is bullshit, you know? That has nothing for me. But then I thought, well, you know, there are a whole lot of people who would disagree. So I thought, what's going on in there? So I'd get her to, we'd go to different churches. In Atlanta, and there wasn't a lot to choose from, frankly. But we'd go, and I would just listen and watch and think, is there something going on here? Right? Is there something that I'm an outsider. I don't understand really what this is. But I was just listening. I was just hearing. I was trying to sense, is there something alive? And then when I first encountered Buddhism, it was like, oh, yes. There's a story that Jershan was traveling with two of his monastic brothers, Fayang and Wudong, and they came to Dijang's monastery. It was snowing and cold, and they got sort of cloistered there for a while because they couldn't travel. So the first night they were huddled around the charcoal burner trying to get warm, and they were ignoring Dijang, which is not polite. And they were just having their own conversation. So Dijang sort of shimmied up and said, I wonder if I could ask you, monks, something, a question. They said, sure, if there's something you want to ask, we'd be happy to help out. And Dijang said, are the mountains, rivers, and earth identical or separate from you elders? And Jershan said, separate. And Jershan said, identical, identical. And Dijang held up two fingers. And then he walked away. And Fayan said, what do you think he was getting at? Yeah. Holding up two fingers. And Jershan said, he just did that arbitrarily. And Fayan said, I don't know. Don't be so quick to insult him. The next day, they took off to leave. And Fayan, who went on to be an important teacher in his own way, said, you brothers go ahead. I'm going to stay behind and see if Dijang has something to offer. If I don't find that, then I'll come and find you. They all came back. They all ended up coming back. And Jershan went on to become his successor. Are they separate or the same? There's extensive discussion going on down south. So there's a question, in a sense, in Buddhist practice. What is the role of your thinking mind? Of course, you know, our thoughts, our distracted thoughts, our kind of habitual thinking, our obsessive thinking, you know, those are cloud-making, right? They really obscure the natural clarity of our mind. They make it very difficult to develop mindfulness and concentration. So we have to work with that mind, with those distractions. So that's pretty clear and obvious. I think everybody, meditator, understands that. But at a deeper level, what is the role of the more powerful aspect of our mind, which has the ability to reason, to think critically, right? To engage something and try and understand it. What is the role of that? Does it have a role? And one teacher said, you might wonder how logic and reasoning can cause us to realize what is beyond concepts. How can that which is based in concepts help us to go beyond concepts? And how could such an intellectual approach take us beyond our intellect? Usually we think of this as meditation's role, right? Is to let go of all of that and move beyond. But there are schools of Buddhism and lineages and teachers who believe that the role of reasoning is important, emphasized. And I should say that there are differences of opinions around this, right? There are teachers and very, you know, important, powerful, respected lineages and teachers that feel that it has a very minimal role. But in here, this teacher is saying, because it's difficult to realize the true nature of reality and attain liberation without first developing certainty in emptiness, then reasoning is important. Reasoning is emphasized. And I would say not just certainty, that is having faith in something that we don't know yet, we haven't experienced. And so there are teachings that try and cultivate, through reasoning, a faith in emptiness. And I would also say what's important is in that process to understand, what does that even mean? What does emptiness even mean? Because it's just a word in English. And if when we hear that word, and as I think almost probably all of us did, I certainly did, I started imagining different way, what is emptiness? It's a big black hole. It's outer space. It's a tunnel you fall into and never come out of. You know, it's like, what is emptiness? And it's none of those things. And so to have actually develop a good understanding of it. having an opinion that things are empty or a general understanding of emptiness isn't really going to do much good. Emptiness doesn't appear to our senses, right? We can't touch it, and so we don't ordinarily think about it because it's not something we encounter in our senses. Since it is one of the most profound and unfamiliar topics, we need explanations and study to come to terms with it. We already believe there are so many reasons that things exist. That's where we start. Of course things exist. And each of these reasons need to be examined so that we can develop confidence that maybe that way of seeing things ain't necessarily so. And so in practice, particularly in our tradition and with Bodhidharma's teachings on being outside scriptures, there's a tendency to think meditating, being free of all thoughts, being free of all rational thinking is better, than having thoughts, than thinking, than having rational, conceptual thoughts. So we rank them, right? But ultimately, they have to be unified, or we have to realize them as unified. If we're going to be active, integrated, living bodhisattvas on an enlightening path, we're not going to leave our thinking mind behind. So to actually really understand it and not put it in rank, of course, in the beginning, we're so default to the thinking mind that we do need to be sort of dedicated to freeing ourselves of that and developing this more stable mind. But not to judge it in the ways that we tend to do. Do not judge by any standards, we chanted this morning. And so we tend to, in this way and other ways, make assumptions about what practice is, about what we should be doing, about what is right and wrong, what is good and bad. And a lot of times we're just making that stuff up based on what we already know, based on the way we've lived our lives, what we already think is true and what is not true. Of course, we have to use standards in many aspects of our life. We have to guide ourselves in Zazen. So in a sense, the standard that we guide ourselves with are the teachings. Am I practicing according to the Dharma if I want to be practicing Buddha Dharma? But we can forget or lose sight of the fact that those standards are created. They don't exist in any absolute sense. That's why Buddhism really speaks in terms of what is skillful, what is helpful, rather than what is absolute truth or absolute non-truth. Because those standards by which we judge things become part of our identity, our attachments. So the angry mind, the greedy heart, uses the standards that arise out of such a mind, out of such a heart, to see the world, to experience things, to see other people, to relate. And anger and greed and pride and jealousy, the kleshas, will always create more separation and will ultimately always be used against someone, something. Those kleshas by themselves, in and of themselves, in a sense, motivated by those very strong, deeply embedded emotions, lead us to create ranks and hierarchies and elevate and degrade and exclude and include, and ultimately to create a whole, as the Buddha said, a whole mass of suffering. I was listening to an historian recently, and she said, in every society, in every culture, there is the question of who has the power. Is it the church? Is it a government? Is it a dictator? And of course, in our country, what was established a long time ago is it's supposed to be the people. That's where the power lies. It's the people. She said that the nature of power is when somebody has it, they want more. Frederick Douglass said, power does not yield in and of itself, right? We don't want to give it up. And so then the question becomes for a Buddhist is, for whose benefit is that power being wielded? And to what end? What is it being used for? You could say that in Buddhist practice, you're developing what is sometimes referred to as a spiritual power, right? And it is a kind of power. When your mind settles, there's a kind of power. You feel it. When your body comes into alignment, there's a power. You might think of it as energy. You might think of it as a loss of tension. We might sort of describe it to ourselves in different ways, but it's a kind of power that's being brought forth that exists within us. For whose benefit is that power? To what end? This historian was talking about Trump responding to these tariffs for which the real world and the stock market and economy is, you know, tanking. And he sent out a note saying, this is a great time to get rich, richer than ever before. Only the weak will fail. And there we have it. Kind of sums it up. Who wants the power? And for what reason? And for whose benefit? And so, hundreds of thousands of people gathered yesterday. Many of you, thank you for your service on all of our behalf to try and get things clear. There's extensive discussion. It's exhausting. The Buddha said one of the four forms of speech, which is not right speech, is idle chatter. Oh my Lord, could he have ever guessed how much idle chatter was possible to be endured? It is not neutral. We know that. Even when the words themselves are clearly not neutral, just the noise itself is not neutral. It has an effect to exhaust, to tire, to numb. Jershan says, there's extensive discussion. Dijang says, well, how that can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat? How can that compare? Is he just talking about ranks? What I'm doing is much better than having discussion. Well, that would seem obvious. But in a koan, it's never what seems obvious. Because if it's obvious, everybody would get that. And what difference has that made? None. And so we always have to look deeper. How can that compare? There's a moment in which there is no comparison. The subject and object fall away. This moment is not standing in relationship to another. Think about when you're bored. You know, what is boredom? You're sitting and you're bored, right? Where's your mind? Where's your breath in that moment? Are you actually sitting? Because boredom can only happen when this moment stands in comparison to some other possible moment that's a whole bunch better. When there is just this moment, how could there be boredom? How can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat? He's talking about a way of being, about a way of planting a field, planting rice. I was reading this article about this company that's one of many who's building robots. And they were touting the humanoid form and teaching it to do like household things, like washing dishes, sweeping a floor, those things so that you never have to do them again. Oh my God, I've been waiting. How far can we go to degrade and minimize and belittle the ordinary things of living? Well, clearly, so that because we have better things to do, like TikTok, right? It's frightening. because it's so seductive. I won't have to do that anymore. I won't have to wash any dishes. I won't have to clean my bathroom. Has that person ever actually cleaned their dishes? Have they ever actually cleaned a bathroom? That's what you're given the opportunity to do here when you come here, is to actually clean a bathroom in a way that cannot compare. Not because it's the brightest, cleanest bathroom ever, and you have won, but because there's nothing outside of that. There's no before, there's no after. And so he says, well, what can you do about the world? And he says, what do you call the world? I've been reading Edward Yong's book on an immense world, and he talks about, I can only read a little bit of this, but he talks about the very beginning. Imagine an elephant in a room. And in that room, there's a real elephant. He says, it's not the elephant in the room. No, it's an actual elephant. It's an elephant, there's a mouse, there's a robin, there's an owl, there's a bat, there's a rattlesnake, there's a spider, there's a mosquito, there's a bumblebee, and there's a woman, let's call her Rebecca, he says. They're all in this room. He says, the elephant raises his trunk like a periscope. The rattlesnake flicks out its tongue. The mosquito cuts through the air with its antenna. All three are smelling. All of them are in the act of smelling what there is to smell in that room. The elephant sniffs nothing of note. The rattlesnake detects the trail of the mouse and gets ready to strike. The mosquito smells the alluring carbon dioxide on Rebecca's breath and the aroma of her skin. And he goes on to talk about how each of these creatures, these living beings in this room, are in the same room at the same time having very different experiences. What do you call the world? He says, Rebecca has the clearest eyesight of everybody in the room until the lights go out. Plunged into darkness, she's in trouble, but some of the other creatures are now ready to go. He says, these seven creatures share the same physical space, but experience it in wildly and wondrously different ways. The same is true for the billions of other animal species on the planet and the countless individuals within those species. Earth teems in sights and textures, sounds and vibrations, smells and tastes, electric and magnetic fields, but every animal can only tap into a small fraction of the reality's fullness or completeness. Each is enclosed within its own unique sensory bubble, perceiving but a tiny sliver of an immense world. And that's really important, I think, as practitioners for us to bear in mind, because the teachings often talk about, you know, that we're going to experience reality as it is, as though there is an objective reality out there that we can experience without our senses. And that we will experience that same objective reality like the elephant and the bat and the robin and the mosquito. Buddhism is concerned with the human world. And so we have to practice with this human form using our human senses. And in fact, realization, enlightenment, even though the thing itself of enlightenment, what is realized is beyond concept, it's not realization until it comes into cognition. Until it comes into cognition, there's no realization. There's nothing that has been realized. And so in that sense, what is ineffable, what is beyond any sense organ has to, in some strange way that words can't really describe, come into a sense of something. Kind of interesting. Our world appears to us as the world. And historically, when other creatures have an experience, like when we test intelligence of animals, we test them according to what we think intelligence is. And if they can't perform those functions, then we think, okay, this animal doesn't have any intelligence, right? If you set the standards of the test, you are sure to rank high, right? If you're deciding what counts, isn't that kind of like the reference field of the self? The self decides, sets the standards for what matters, what doesn't, who's in, who's out, what's smart, what's not, who's worthy, who's not. He says there's a word for this. It's called Umwelt. It's the field in which we have sensory awareness. And I was thinking, what, you know, a person who lives by anger, lives by greed, who is thrilled, whose Umwelt is rich, richer than ever, and only the weak will fail. If they were in the same room as an enlightened being, a bodhisattva, could that person appreciate, have any sensory experience of the bodhisattva's world? They certainly have the capacity, because we all have the same nature. But is their Umwelt so different that they actually can't experience that? That the suffering of that other person is outside their Umwelt. Their senses are not tuned or not practiced or not alive to experience. And remember, one of the sense organs is the mind, which means thought, which means belief, views. So the mind is sensing things through our thoughts and creating logic and reason and worlds and ideologies. And so in that way, of course, a person whose life, whose mind, whose Umwelt is very limited is going to replicate that by creating a very confined and constricted and limited life and world. And all of those creatures, two-legged and more, who are not recognized as having intelligence or having the qualities that the standards within this other Umwelt have established, they don't matter. They don't count. When the Umwelt of a country is defined by race or gender or wealth or power, then even an elephant could deceive itself into believing that its world is the world. So I've been drawing a little bit from this book by Wendell Berry that I've been reading. I finally finished it, so I can't promise this will be the last time I draw from it. But he speaks to this in a way that I found useful. And he's actually talking about Albert Schweitzer, the Christian missionary, musician, physician, philosopher, and about sort of talking about the material progress, technical, technological, industrial progress, and ethical progress. And he says it became obvious that there was never a possibility that ethical progress would or could ever develop in union or in parallel with material progress. Material progress was never going to wait for ethics to catch up. And I think that's just a very true and succinct way of describing. It's just, right? Can't hold back progress. And progress means something very, it's a very particular Umwelt, right? Ethics, you know, if you can squeeze it in, but that's not really what's important here. And so Schweitzer came to a realization that, of what he called reverence for life, which he described, he said, a person is ethical only when life as such is sacred to them, and that of plants and animals, and when they devote themselves helpfully to all life that is in need of help, that is reverence for life. It's large. It includes everything, right? So when we think about, you know, what is good for humanity, what do we need to do to take care of the human species? All of the things that are important, but as though we're alone, as though if we can just make it good for humans, then everything else will be okay. He talks about people who have revered, this is Wendell Berry, who have revered life, and those who still revere it, and that there have been people forever, since the beginning, and there are still many who revere life. I would say, venture to guess, there are few in this room. It's hard to practice Buddha Dharma for long and not to begin to experience life in a different way and begin to touch something that we might even timidly, shyly, even reluctantly begin to think of as sacred. I was very timid about that. It was like, I don't know about that. I don't know. That was sort of a loaded word for me. But there was a point at which it was just undeniable. There's something going on here. There's something going on here. And he says, to those for whom life, it begins to be understood as reverent, he says, it has appeared to them to be a great miracle. That's why there's reverence. Unaccountable on the terms of available knowledge. Can't explain it. He says, that is because life itself is not a substance. It's not a thing. That's why it's a miracle. That's why it is of reverence. He says, air and light are oak and iron in comparison to life itself. And he says, because of this, because it's not a thing, because it's not a substance, he says, life itself has never been isolated or captured or confined. You can't buy it. It's not a piece of real estate. You can only give it value in your heart, right? There's no stock on Wall Street. He says, we can see how generous and abounding is the commonwealth of life in comparison to that merely of humans or humanity, and how fairly we could almost say how democratically it is portioned out among the creatures, a mouse, a horse, a butterfly, a fly, a microbe. They all have their own portion of life. He says, his life is now isolatable, is not isolatable, or empirically knowable. This is just another way of saying it's not reducible. It can't be reduced. It can't be reduced to money, to a house, to a job, to a position, a role. It's not isolatable. It cannot be made into anything that it's not. It's not a thing. It's not something that we can have only for ourselves or something we can compete for or take away from others and so have more for ourselves. Our life can be made more abundant, as Jesus said, but not by any quantifiable amount. Wendell Berry's a Christian. We cannot have life for ourselves alone, but only in common with other living creatures. We were talking earlier in the week how you can't have morality by yourself. Doesn't make sense. You can't have language by yourself. We can only have it together. Doesn't exist as an isolatable thing. And in that way, it's not quantifiable. Right? How much morality do you have today? Right? Can you gain a little of that moral weight? It's not like that. But we know it. When it's present, we see it when it's not. But that's not morality. It's what we do with our morality or our lack of it. He says, we and our kind must live if we are to live for very long. We need to, in order to live for very long, we need to obey absolutely nature's requirements to keep all of her places helpful, healthful, and whole, and to waste nothing. We need to use sparingly, carefully, kindly, and gratefully all that we must use. Buddhism has been practicing this way for centuries. Right? To take care of what we have, to have just enough when we take our formal meals, orioki. It means the right amount. And here specifically we're talking about food, but it's in relationship to my hunger. What is the right amount? What is the necessary amount? The amount that is reverential of life. What is the amount that is obeying nature's laws because they don't change, right? We can't bend them. And we can say that we have to live according to our own natural laws. We call that dharma. But the thing is, as human beings, we don't have to. And when we don't, those laws don't bend, right? We can defy impermanence, but impermanence is a natural law. It's not debatable, right? We can try to defy death, but that's just magical thinking, right? We can think that an attachment is the same as love, but it's not. These are basic truths, basic laws. When we obey them, live in accord with them, we flourish. Life flourishes. Life has reverence. When we don't, we desecrate what is sacred. As we are not whole in ourselves when divided from other humans, Wendell Berry says, so we are not whole as humans when divided from all other creatures. So we are not whole as creatures when divided from the earth, from a home country, and the landmarks and the reminders of a home country, from those places of sacredness that we each have. And if we do not have them, they're there. This is a place that is sacred for many of us. Why? Is it the architecture? Is it the building? The architecture is quite marvelous, right? If we were in a warehouse, it wouldn't be quite the same. But sacredness ultimately is not in the space. It, in a sense, draws, if there is natural beauty in the space, draws that out, magnifies it. But what makes this space sacred, I believe, is what has been happening in this space for 45 years. And in a sense, by extension, for 2,500 years. And so then, those of us who practice here, something starts to happen. There's a kind of a bonding, a binding, a kinship, a something alive, a reverence that goes in both directions, a kind of nourishment. Sometimes people speak of it as coming home. These are not quantifiable things. You can feel it, but you can't possess it. Nobody's given it to you. But you are definitely part of it. He says, we are now down to one significant choice. We can take our stand either on the side of life or on the side of death. Now, of course, Buddhism sees these as non-dual because they are. So another way of saying this is we can either live in a way that is in accord with the nature of things, or we can live in a way that is not in accord with the nature of things. This will never be presented to us as one large and final choice, but only as a succession of small choices, continuing to the 7th and 700th generation. And I think that's an extremely important point, right? Because when we see the world in its state, I mean, don't you just want the final solution, right? The ultimate fix that's just going to, like, fix it. And what Berry is saying is what we understand as practitioners. You don't get to the top of the mountain in a leap. You have to walk one simple, small, seemingly insignificant step at a time. And in the same way, to be a practitioner means we have to make choices each day to sit, to practice, to be mindful, to care, to take responsibility, to examine, and we have to keep making those choices. But we can do that because they're just today's choices. You don't have to make one choice forever. Nobody can do that. It's just now. It's like every time you're sitting, in a moment, your mind wanders, you make a choice, right? And then you just do that again, and you do that. And the more we do that, the easier it begins to be to make that choice. Until it's not really a choice anymore. It's just your life. And that life has reverence. And I think that's really important in terms of, like, yesterday's rally that was happening all across the country, it was happening in other countries. Did it work? Right? Did it work? Right? Has everything changed? No, everything has not changed. Has something changed? Yes. Because what happened today, or yesterday, created karma, because you had hundreds of thousands of people with minds, with intentions, coming together, sharing something, and expressing it. In some sense, I would venture to say, of things moving frighteningly out of accord and trying to bring it back into accord. Let's actually obey the laws that we live within, of nature, of the earth, of Buddha nature, of a civil society. And so as a practitioner, to ask, did it work, is not the right question. It's not a helpful question. It's rather, is this a good use of my time? Is this a good action? Is this an intentionally good action? What do I want to do with this? Not what is the consequence of it. Because that will stop us. So I'll let Wendell have the last word. He says, if we worked for the world's life in good faith, with sufficient love, and knowing how our work would become good. And I have to read that again. If we worked for the world's life in good faith, with sufficient love, and knowing how our work would become good. Our work itself would be good. Because we're working for the life of the world, and we're doing that within good faith. We could say good understanding, clear views, and we're doing it with sufficient love, compassion, concern. Sufficient. He doesn't say total, complete, absolute, sufficient. And he says, in this way, it would become beautiful. It would make us happy. And not with the future happiness of political promising. It would make us happy as soon as we began to do it. Maybe those who are coming to practice for the first time have had a sense of something, even when it's difficult, that in those first moments, it is the beginning of something that is good, even if you don't yet know why or what or how.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.